put on your comment card which agenda item or what you want to speak about. Last time I was kind of blank. Some of them just said deer on it or elk, and I kind of had trouble with that. So, second item, approval of agenda and minutes. Has anybody looked at their minutes?
I motion we accept this.
We got a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Do we have a motion and a second? All those in favor? Unanimous. Wildlife Board meeting update. I'm just going to cover the items that we dealt with for the Northeastern. On the deer management plan, that went what it was voted on and accepted as presented by the DWR. We had the 18-1. Something that, well, certain individuals here, sometimes that something that I thought we could I could mention, and Carrie, I believe, brought up the comment, if we had the whole state 18-1, you know, why have the units? And one of the things that caught my attention was sometimes the justification of this, there's a chronic wasting disease. Some units need to be managed a little different than other units. I still like the units, but the statewide at 18-1. So the plan was accepted as presented. On the our motion, on the Bookcliffs deer tags and elk tags, the board went with our motion to reduce the total of elk tags to 130, but the deer, we had the motion to cut the deer tags by 50, and that failed. Some of the comments was made on there is the Bookcliff unit at one time was apparently closed and opened up, and I guess there hasn't been a lot of change, but anyway, but it wasn't a bad motion to send down because it was talked about, so it'll be next time it comes around if we have a concern about it. That should be fresh on the mind of the board. So, and that, other than that, things went just about the way our meeting went. And that's all I have on that one. Update.
Regional update. Okay. I just wanted to talk for just a minute regarding the coyotes and the legislature passed two bills on coyotes, and one was a $5 increase on license fees, and the other was to increase the amount of money for the bounty program. And just to remind you, or at least to mention that's for the counties that participate in the bounty program, that can be increased.
That's not going to be run through the county. That will be a DWR program. It will not be a county bounty program.
Okay. Anyways, we don't have a lot ready to go on that yet until July 1st. When the bills go into effect or take into effect, the director and his staff right now are looking into what to do with those funds. One of the things that he has mentioned that I think is extremely important that we put emphasis where it's going to help. There's lots of data out there that says if you just go out there and you just go to shoot coyotes or you go to take coyotes anywhere, it's not going to do deer any good at all. And so our goal is to direct effort where it's going to do the most good, where we're going to get some bang for the buck. And so the division is really looking hard at how we're going to develop this program, working with Wildlife Services, and we're not just going to go out and just kill coyotes. We're also going to research and collect data and information to identify whether it works or not, because we really don't know if it's going to work or not. We really don't know that killing coyotes in one area for deer, if that's going to help fawn survival or not. It may. It may. And so we want to participate in that. We want to look at it. We want to study it, research, and collect data and provide data to the state and to our RACs and our wildlife board and let them make some decisions as to what they're going to do. And so there's going to be a lot of work on that over the next several years. And, in fact, Kevin is probably participating a lot with that and how we're doing it and what we're going to do. We have a statewide leadership team meeting coming up, and I see that the director is going to talk to us about that and give us more information. So it's kind of an ongoing thing. We're going to continue to get information for you, and we'll provide that to you as we get it. On the fishery side of things, the cutthroat are now staging at Lake Canyon, so they're starting to collect eggs. Our annual lake trout survey will start May 10th, and so today, any of you interested in going out and working with our fisheries folks, contact Trina. I don't know if you have her number or not, but I'm more than willing to give it to you.
Boyd,
Out of town. Well, she's out of town till Thursday, but she'll be back Thursday. So if you want to go down the road, what's that?
Contact me if you want to go.
Okay, contact Ron. we'll let you contact Ron. Make sure that you call, though, after midnight, please. Okay? So call after midnight, and we talk to Ron. And his number is 790-0207, or you can call the office there, and he'll set you up. If you call the office, you're going to have to call between 8 and 5, and that's actually the best time to call. So give him a call, and he'll set you up, and he'll get you out there to look at some lake trout. The Diamond Mountain Creel Survey has started. They'll be doing that 4 times a month for Matt Warner and Calder. Through to November and December. Also, our state parks, they're going to be assisting us in our AIS program and in that workload to try and help us to get all of that done. The biologists are finished collecting data on sage grass and deer. It's not compiled yet, but they've had a real busy spring getting out early in the mornings to get that information and so that we can provide it to you down the road when it comes decision time. So with that, turn the time back over to you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Oh, any questions? Questions?
Comment?
Comments?
When you talk about coyotes?
Any votes or any...
Well, no, I want to make a comment on coyotes.
Oh, you go right ahead.
Talking about coyotes not eating deer, that's like saying a skunk don't stink.
Well, I've seen some. Okay, we will be working out of our new office starting June 4th. So we'll have the same main number, but all of our office numbers will be changed. So we'll have to get those out to you. Emails, of course, will stay the same, but June 4th. We just spent a long day today, and our folks, I should tell you, I'm really proud of our regional staff. They worked really hard today. We unloaded and unloaded two semi-trailers full of furniture. And we got all the furniture in there, and they're going to spend a week setting it up or a week or two setting it up, and then we get to move in. But regional folks did a really nice job of hauling that stuff in. So,
Mr. Blackwell, which license will have the $5 increase on it?
That's our hunting permits.
The combination or the deer tag itself?
Deer tag.
Okay.
It's just permits, not licenses. So all big game permits, antlered and antlerless.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, let's move into the conservation permit rule. Kevin?
Can you let the lights on again? You did such a good job our last meeting, or Amy. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to talk about the conservation permit rule. We look over this rule at least once every 3 years and sometimes more often, but every 3 years when we issue conservation permits to the groups, which happens primarily on a three-year rotation, we always take a look at the rule to make sure everything's working right. But for those of you that aren't familiar with it, I'll give you a little bit of history and the background of the rule and talk about some of the accomplishments. I will hit briefly on the results of a legislative audit that took place this past year and the recommendations that came out of that, and then we are recommending a few tweaks to the rule. So just the history, it began in 1991 with a single bighorn sheep permit, and at that time it was marketed by the Division of Wildlife. Shortly after that, it expanded to a maximum of one permit per species, and it stayed that way through 1994. We kind of went into an era of expansion beginning in 1997, and to just give you an idea of that, in dollar values, for the first 17 years of the program, or 18 years, from 1991 to 1998, the program raised a total of $1.3 million. The next five-year period, it raised $5.7 million. The next five-year period, it raised $12.5 million. In the last 2 years, the program's raised $5.3 million. We're probably not going to see a lot of growth in it from right now. It's up and running. It's kind of what it is at this point. But since 1991, the program has generated over $25 million. Now, part of the reason, or one of the things that the division really likes this program for, is if you look at all the western states, all the states around us, the proportion of non-resident to resident licenses, the ratio in all the other states is much higher than it is in Utah. They run their agency or do some of their programs on the backs of non-residents because they can charge higher permit fees. We have the lowest percentage by far at 5% of our permits going to non-residents, and that's largely because of this program allows us to generate income to get some of the other programs, to get programs done so that we can keep permits in the hands of our residents. So that was one of the main motivations and one of the reasons we keep the program going. So just some history on the regulation. It's been modified at least seven times in the last 13 years, and just briefly what those are. In 1999, we capped the number of permits at 8 for any area. We put in some evaluation and performance, or a formula for evaluating performance. Clarified that a recipient may designate another person if they're successful in the big game draw, so they don't end up with two premium elk tags in 1 year, one that they purchase and then one that they draw through the drawing. In 2000. We put a stipulation in that the money can be used for other than the species that generate it if it's agreed upon both by the division and by the groups, but it does have to be a conservation permit species. So it's always used for game species. It's never used for anything else. And specifically the game species that are part of the program. Also in 2000, we added statewide conservation permits for turkey, cougar, and bear. Then in 2002, we clarified that only one application per conservation organization, gave the board the ability to select a recipient other than the high bidder if some very specific criteria are met, added criteria for limiting growth of the program, and then also the board can authorize a second statewide permit for special events or purposes. In 2003, we added a stipulation that 90% of the funds raised must be used on projects that benefit conservation permit species. We added auditing and accounting procedures, and then also the process for project reporting and approval. In 2006, we defined specifically what the conservation species were. There had been a couple of things that had come in and out. Swans were part of the program at one time, I think. Sandhill cranes.
some things that kind of come in and out of the program. At this time, it's defined as deer, elk, pronghorn, moose, bison, bighorn, sheep, turkey, cougar, and bear. Also in 2006 is when we instituted the multi-year conservation permit program. So now the majority of the groups are allocated permits on a three-year time period. And then changed the rule a little bit for bighorn sheep to allow 10% of bighorn sheep permits to be used as conservation permits. In 2007, we added that the person identified on the permit or voucher must also have a combination or hunting license. That's the same year that we required everybody that applies in the draw to have a license before they can do so. So to make this program consistent with that. And then just in 2010, we added some special Antelope Island permits for mule deer and bighorn sheep. It's a little bit different program. It's cooperative with the Division of Parks and Recreation. And the revenue generated by those two permits goes back to the Division of Parks and Recreation, and to this point it's being used specifically on Antelope Island. Okay, I alluded to the legislative audit. Some of you may not be aware, the legislature has a team of auditors that work just for them, and each year they send them out to audit specific programs within state government, and they ask that the conservation permit program be audited in 2011. And it's kind of all summed up in the conclusion, which the auditor said the sale of conservation permits promotes habitat improvements on public lands with no expense to the taxpayer while negligibly reducing the public's opportunity to draw a permit for a limited entry hunting area. And we would encourage the division to continue to support this program. So I don't know if you can come through an audit much better than that. So just briefly, some accomplishments of the program. Between 2006 through 2011, over 309 projects have benefited in terms of funding from the conservation permit program. We've accomplished a lot of transplants. At least 561 bighorn sheep have been moved, some from out of state moved into Utah, some being moved from within the state of Utah. 350 pronghorn moved, and it was the conservation permit program that allowed us to do the transplant of bison from the Henry Mountains out to the Book Cliffs. It also helps us fund research that there's no way we would be able to do otherwise. And some of those things that are going on right now, the highway mortality, there's a big effort underway, primarily on Highway 6 there in Spanish Fork Canyon, but also at several other points throughout the state. The effects of predators on mule deer, a study that's just getting going now on the Monroe Mountain. The doe and fawn survival study that gets talked about a lot in terms of all the collars that we have spread out around the state. That's being funded almost exclusively by conservation permits. And then we're just beginning a moose survival study starting this year. We have some concerns about what's going on with moose, and there's a lot of ideas out there. We're going to try to see if we can narrow it down and figure out what the limiting factors are. So now to the point, the recommended changes. First, to allow a turkey conservation permit holder to hunt statewide during the general season. Over-the-counter turkey hunting is a new thing, and this just kind of makes it consistent with an over-the-counter turkey hunt. We wanted to specifically define that the potential number of permits is calculated based on the number of permits that were issued the year prior to the three-year cycles that I talked about. So later this year, we will be allocating permits for 2013, 2014, and 2015. The potential number of permits for that three-year time period will be calculated based on the big game recommendations that just went through, the number of tags available in the public draw in 2012. And those will stay consistent for 3 years. Now, this next one, there's some confusion on this. Some of you may have gotten an email alluding to a misinterpretation of what we're trying to do here. This is no different. This table that we've included is exactly the way these permits have been being calculated throughout the life of the program. There's nothing different here. All we're trying to do is add transparency so that everybody knows exactly, you know, where the thresholds are that go from one permit to two permits to three permits to four, on up to eight, where it's capped. Some people, because we took the word maximum out of it, have interpreted that we're trying to grow the program. I just want to say on the record, we're not. This is no different than the way the program's been being run up till this point. Next, We did include a mechanism for reducing the number of conservation permits specifically for once-in-a-lifetime species if the number of permits in the public draw goes down during the three-year period that we allocate permits for. We ran into this situation with moose over the last 3 years. They were calculated on 2009 moose permits, which at that time moose permits were still fairly high. Over the last 3 years, moose permits have gone down quite a bit, and so that percentage was way off because the downward trend of the number of moose permits. So this will give us, if we get in that situation again, give us a way we can go in and pull some permits back out of the conservation permit program to make things more equitable with the public permits. And then lastly, we're recommending that we change the timing for when funds are transferred to the division from the conservation organizations. Right now, we invoice the groups after we complete a project. The problem with that is they bid on projects based on what we estimate the project will cost. So if the project comes in under budget, they get an invoice for less than what they bid. They've already taken that out of their account, and it makes the books hard to balance, I guess. So all we're trying to do is put the burden to keep track of that on the division rather than the group. Some of the groups have paid staff, and it's not a problem for them. Others are kind of run on a shoestring, and it's they don't have people that they can devote to doing that. So the burden will come on the division to make sure we keep the money right. So that's the end of the recommended changes. I appreciate your attention. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions? Questions from the audience? I didn't get any comment cards. Didn't get any comment cards? Nobody's got any questions? You done good. Comments? Yeah. Comments? Got one?
What's the comment on conservation? So does Josh.
Troy? Please state your name.
Troy Justinson, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. We've been involved in the conservation permit program since the inception, and we'd just like to recommend the board adopt the proposal the division placed on these changes. We think it's great changes and appreciate the opportunity to participate in the program.
Thank you. And Josh?
Josh Horrocks. One problem in the conservation permit program, and maybe Kevin can correct me, but we get issued a northeastern region cougar permit to be auctioned for conservation dollars. That permit is only good for limited entry units for cougars. We don't have a limited entry unit for cougars in the northeast region, nor do we want one, but it would be nice if that conservation permit could be used in split units also. I'm an outfitter, and I know it'd mean $2,500 to $5,500 in conservation money. So I just think it's a problem, and maybe we could vote on it to amend it or something.
Yeah, I think there's a misunderstanding. Actually, conservation permits are for any open unit. They can go onto split units or harvest objective units as long as they haven't closed yet. And we are going to make a change to the way we issue, though. They're not going to be regional-based anymore. We now have these 8 cougar management areas that, you know, we talked about a year ago. Those are more defined areas. Units don't cross boundaries like they do with if we do them regionally, we have some units that cross regional boundaries. That's been a source of confusion. These are set on set unit boundaries, and so they will be issued a little bit differently, but conservation permits can be used on limited entry units and units that are harvest objective units that aren't closed.
Josh?
Josh, that's actually...
We might as well...
We should catch this on the mic.
Oh, could we get you on the mic?
Well, at our SFW banquet, I purchased the Northeast Region Cougar Conservation Permit. And then Byron looked into it and said that it wasn't good. So we don't have a limited entry unit. We couldn't use it on split units until the split unit, open to a split. You know, a split unit is it's limited for a while and then it opens to harvest objective. And so I was under the understanding and was told that you couldn't use that permit on a split unit like when it opened November 17th. So if that's the case, the conservation permit is pretty much useless in our area other than a $50 harvest objective cougar tag over the counter.
I think you were misinformed on the split unit part, but you're right. If you had an area that was all harvest objective, there'd be no point in having a conservation tag because the $50 harvest objective tag gets you access to everywhere that the conservation permit would.
So this permit that I bought, it'll be good from our book for split unit.
It should
this
be
this November 17th.
I'll double check the rule, Josh, and email you if it's different than that. But I'm 99% sure that's the rule. In fact, I can look that up in the packet and.
But Byron Bateman, he asked somebody out there in Salt Lake, and that's what he was told, and he didn't make me pay for the permit.
Sounds like we had a miscommunication.
Okay.
I'll double check it.
Okay.
So. Josh,
thank you.
Did you not have to pay for that tag then?
No, because
it's useless in our area because we don't have a limited entry cougar permit, cougar unit in our Northeast region.
Okay.
Josh, the current unit is actually purely limited entry. It's always $10. So there was some misinformation or something, but that's not true. It's only one unit compared to it.
And that's in the Northeast Division.
That's a Wasatch Mountains current.
Oh,
you might have just cost yourself some money, Josh.
Mr. Bunnell, is there any regulation on that through these sportsmen's group? Can they not charge for a conservation tag?
There is a penalty that they would incur if they did that, because when we issue the next round of conservation permits, it's based on performance in the program. So they bid on a tag at a certain amount.
Yeah.
If they sell it for less than what they bid on it for, they incur a penalty. So obviously they would have bid on it for a certain amount. If they give it away, then they get issued a penalty and their performance goes down, which means the order that they choose permits in the next time we allocate 3-year permits, okay, they get lower on, they get a lower position.
Okay.
So that's how that would work.
That's how that's managed.
Yep.
That's interesting. Thank you.
No further comment? Call for a motion?
I move to accept as presented by the state.
We have a motion
second.
To accept and a second.
Second.
All those in favor? It's unanimous. Thank you. This collection. Paul?
Good evening. My name is Paul Birdsey. I'm the Coldwater Sport Fish Coordinator in Salt Lake, and I've been asked to come and talk to you tonight about the collection, importation, transportation, and possession of animals rule. And don't even try and say that 3 times fast. Some of you may remember that the division brought this rule out to the RACs about a year to a year and a half ago. During that process, there were some significant shortfalls that were identified through the RAC process. So since then, we've been working on trying to fix those, and we're bringing it back out now. Because we understand that there's some new board members that may have not been introduced to this subject before, tonight I want to spend just a couple of minutes and talk about all the changes that we're recommending for the rule, rather than just those that have been identified since that last go-round with the RACs. First of all, what is a CIP? It's a cooperative rule with the DWR, the Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Health, and its purpose is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public, regulate possession of wildlife, and protect the genetic integrity of wildlife and livestock. And it provides a mechanism for the DWR to regulate activities for protected wildlife unrelated to hunting or sport fishing. And it governs issuing certificates of registration to allow these activities and defines what activities for which a COR is required. There's three different classifications of wildlife underneath the in the CIP. There's a non-controlled species that have been judged that there will be no detrimental impact to either the wild population for a native species, which there are no non-controlled native species, but there's no detrimental impact for having the possession of these species, so a COR is not required. There's controlled, that there's possible detrimental impact, a COR is required. And then there are prohibited species that possessing them would present a significant detrimental impact to the wild population in the terms of, in regard to native species, or for non-native species, having those species in the state and having the potential for escapement could present a threat to native wildlife. And they will only, a COR for those species will only be issued in accordance with this rule and with federal laws. Okay, species not covered by this rule is either added or redefined. Cat is defined as only recognized domestic breeds. Dogs, defined as domestic dogs and hybrids. And swine, or domestic or feral. And a question came up the other night about wild boar. And basically, if they came from a domestic stock, whether they've just then been released and now they're feral pigs or they're still domestic, those are covered by the Department of Agriculture. If they originated from a wild stock, such as Russian boar, they come under the authority of the Division of Wildlife Resources. Okay, some definitions. Domestic is just commonly considered domestic animals. Animals, the definition was revised to include hybrids between domestic and wild animals. And perhaps the biggest change to this version of the rule is that the ornamental fish term was revised to be ornamental aquatic animal species, and that's to include crustaceans and mollusks, which are governed by this rule but obviously don't fall under the commonly accepted definition of ornamental fish. This term, however, does not include sport fish, bait fish, food fish, native species, prohibited or controlled species. And you need to know that if you agree to approve this rule tonight, you're also going to be agreeing to approve changing this definition in R657-16, the aquaculture and fish stocking rule, and R657-59, fish ponds. This term is also found in the brine shrimp rule, but that's a very large, complex rule that we're not opening at this time. It's up for revision in a year or so anyway, so we're just going to hold off making any minor tweaks to that until we open the rule, and then we'll do it all at once. I guess I should mention that in previously, ornamental fish was defined as basically anything that looked pretty, and so we had people that were saying that Colorado River cutthroat trout, for example, is a very beautiful fish. Therefore, it was an ornamental fish. They wanted it in their little fish pond. This rule changes that to say it does not include sport fish. Okay, moving on to crustaceans. These are prohibited. One is a native crayfish, the Pylos crayfish, and it has threats from two species of introduced crayfish. So their populations are already in jeopardy. We don't want people collecting them under this rule. And then there's an amphipod. You can see that in the lower right-hand corner. It's just a small aquatic invertebrate. There's a species that's located in the Uinta Mountains in Duchesne County. It's been petitioned to list under the Endangered Species Act. The Fish and Wildlife Service, after 90 days, determined that petition was not substantial, which simply means that there was not enough data included in the petition for them to make a judgment as to whether they should proceed further. It doesn't mean it won't be petitioned again. Moving on to mollusks. Floaters, this has nothing to do with what might show up in a public swimming pool. They're a group of clams, bivalves. In the rule currently, they're listed as California floater. That it happens to only be one species that we have here in the state. We're just broadening that definition to say floater so that it takes in all those species. And then there's another group of small mollusks called spring snails. Some of these are found in a single spring in the West Desert, for example. And obviously going out there and collecting significant numbers of these snails, you could completely extirpate the species. More mollusks. There's a native terrestrial snail that's it's also been petitioned to list. It also is not substantial. It's controlled for collection, importation, possession. Western pearl shell, there's been no observations of this species since the 1940s, but no one has looked either. So we don't really know whether they're there or not, but we're saying that they're prohibited for collection, etc. And then there's a non-native snail, which is in fact presenting a lot of problems. It's prohibited for collection, importation, and possession. And at this time, I'll mention that one of the sources of this particular snail has been the pet trade that comes in on vegetation. There's a task force in the division right now, along with the Department of Agriculture, working to try and figure out exactly what is in the pet trade, what is not in the pet trade available, and trying to come up with a better list rather than just saying ornamental fish or ornamental aquatic animal species. We've been told we're crazy because you got to take on the pet trade, you got to take on the internet availability of animals, etc. But it's important, so we're going to try. Okay. New language. All native species not listed in subsection 1 and 2, excluding the ornamentals, are classified as controlled. And then adding all non-native species not listed in subsection 1 and 2 are classified as prohibited. And this is getting towards that idea that we have a lot of problem with illegal introductions and we want to start to ramp up those efforts. Okay, we're adding three species of fish to the prohibited list, the blue catfish, emerald shiner, burbot. Those of you who may fish the gorge know about the burbot. And these are non-native species with known detrimental impacts to native and sport fish. Okay, for mammals, we made this rule consistent with the non-game mammals rule. So except as prohibited in the non-game mammals rule, a person is allowed to kill non-game mammals that are causing damage to their property or crops. And you can see where that is prohibited, you know, for bats and prairie dogs and other sensitive species. And we removed the option from this rule to capture and relocate porcupines, striped skunks, and squirrels. Moving on to birds, a person is not required to obtain a certificate of registration or a federal permit to kill black-billed magpies, cowbirds, house sparrows, European starlings, and domestic pigeons when found damaging personal or real property. And that last part is real important. And if they are taken under these circumstances, the people can use that plumage or other parts of those animals for non-commercial personal use. Raptors, this is just updating to reflect recent changes at the federal level. Formal approval from the division is required to transfer a raptor from a falconry certificate to a propagation certificate that exceeds 8 months in duration. A licensed raptor propagator may temporarily possess and use a falconry raptor for propagation without the division approval, provided that the propagator possesses a signed and dated statement from the falconer authorizing the temporary possession and a copy of the falconer's original Fish and Wildlife Service form. Canada Goose Nest and Egg Registry was created by the Fish and Wildlife Service in 2007 to deal with nuisance Canada geese, and it allows agencies and landowners who register online to destroy Canada goose nests and eggs on their property within urban environments from March 1st to June 30th. They cannot take adult or goslings, and they must report their activities online, and we're amending this CIP to be compliant with the federal regulation. And a justification for that is that Canada geese can be a nuisance in urban situations, and there's currently little that the state can do to help alleviate those problems. So this problem would allow affected landowners to deal with some of the problem, and it's not expected to have any significant impact on wild populations. With that, I'll take any questions.
Questions?
You mentioned, sir, that they would no longer be allowed to transport a porcupine or squirrel. Is mm-hmm. that correct?
Yeah.
Just speaking from a non-consumptive point of view, I know that you're going to run into some issues with people who absolutely refuse to kill a raccoon in their window well. Would you suggest to them just to call the division to have them remove that animal? Or what would you say to do in that happenstance?
If it doesn't have fins, I'm a little bit out of my depth. That's why Kevin is here.
Yeah, there's some people that may object to that. Couple of options. There's companies that will come do it for you. The reason we've taken it out, there's disease issues. We don't necessarily want the public handling. And raccoons, for one thing, can be really nasty.
Yeah, absolutely.
and there's just a lot of liability and reasons not to have people moving animals from one place to another. If you've got a problem, you do have the option to handle that problem lethally by yourself, or there are companies that will come do it for you.
Okay. Would you encourage them to call the division or more of a pest control company?
I would suggest a pest control company. We don't have the personnel to be running around taking raccoons out of everybody's window well.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Any other questions for that? I have a question for you. On the fish ponds, mm-hmm. private ponds, how much will this rule affect the private fish ponds?
Not too much. For the most part, people either want a sport fish to allow their kids or grandkids, and they've already, for the most part, had to go through a certificate of registration process. There are areas which are exempt. They're not going to change. What it does do is simply changes the definition. For that rule, it changes the definition of what is an ornamental. They can't bring in a red-eared sunfish, for example, from the Midwest, and say, I want this in my pond because it's a pretty fish. Everybody's going to agree that it is a beautiful fish, but it also has potential negative impacts for our native fish and also for our sport fish populations. We see very little of that, but it's kind of closing a loophole that really hasn't been pushed open too far yet anyway.
So you have two definitions of personal sport fish ponds, correct?
Yeah, they're the ponds that are in conservation areas. For example, in areas where there may be native cutthroat trout. Those ponds require a certificate of registration. That information's available online to where those areas are. And then there are areas that are outside of these conservation areas. There's a list of species that they can use in those areas, but they're not required to get a COR. They can contact a regional office, get an exemption certificate listing what species they want to stock in there. It's no cost, and it's done in 5 minutes over the counter.
Mr. Birdsey, what are the repercussions for illegally transplanting a sport fish in your own private pond? I don't think a lot of people actually know that.
Okay. It is illegal to transport live fish, whether it's a game species or non-game species. It's a Class B, I believe it's a Class B misdemeanor if you're caught transporting them, and Class A if you're actually seen stocking those into a natural water, a public waterway. I think the fine for just simply transporting them can be up to $2,500 and something a lot more than that if you actually are seen putting them into a natural
water.
Do you know how many kids you see on the shore?
That is
shore of the
good
Gorge,
information.
Kansas.
I would encourage, if possible, just as kind of a side note, if it's possible to form a video informing even possibly students. I know that we could get that integrated into an ecology course or even the fifth grade ecology course of study.
That's an excellent idea. I will try actually to remember that idea by the time I get back to my chair here. I'm going to write that down. And we're looking at, like I said, we have this illegal introduction task force, and we're looking for ways of approaching that problem. This is an excellent idea.
With a captive audience in the school system, I think that would be an exceptional idea. And with the utilization of YouTube and the Internet, basically the only cost incurred would be the formation of the video itself, because at that point it's viral, it can be seen and utilized essentially for free.
Yep, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Questions from the audience? Comments from the rack? No comments? No comment cards, so I call for a motion. Bob?
I'll second it.
Ron. We've got a motion and a second. All those in favor? Unanimous? Division variance rule. Greg?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and RAC members. My name is Greg Sheehan with the Administrative Services Section from the Salt Lake office. Tonight we'll be presenting the Division Variance Rule, which is R657-57, and this is an action item. A little bit of background what the variance rule even is. It's not one that most of the public or even our RACs are very familiar with. The Wildlife Board is quite familiar with it because they have to address a lot of these issues as they arise. Basically, this rule is out there for individuals who become ill or injured, or their families become ill or injured, or some event like that happens, maybe military activation or whatever, and that precludes them from being able to use a hunting permit after they've drawn it in that particular year. So back a few years ago, the Wildlife Board had to hear any requests for a variance. So if somebody had some situation happen in life, they would come to the board and ask for some form of relief. Because that was becoming time-consuming, and a lot of those had some repetition in nature, the board asked the division to develop a rule, and we did that in 2008. That went out through this public process. And basically, you know, one of the criteria is that within 200 days of the end of a season, that individual had to contact the division, and so we could take them through those different available options. The board still handles some of the requests that come up, but the rule did create a division variance committee, and they handle most of those, and I'll show you a little bit of info on that in a minute. Most of the variances, if you're wondering what these variances really ended up in, is that they granted that individual an opportunity to hunt in a future season, so it kind of moved them forward. Okay, it's kind of hard to read there a little bit, so I'll tell you what those categories are. The reasons that these were approved last year, about 60% were for an individual that became ill or injured. About a third of those are for family members that became ill or injured. A few for military and a few for other things. So it's basically mostly for individuals or their family members. Okay, so here's what's happened since we brought this rule to you in 2008. You can see we're having on the left of that line before the rule, about 20 of these a year made their way to the Wildlife Board for a request for relief under some form of variance. And again, there was no rule then, so it's whatever the board kind of came up with. Once we created a structure here, the public appreciated that and kind of caught on to that. But you can see this sort of exponential growth that we've had of individuals come in asking for a variance relief. And most of these people, as I mentioned, the relief that they've been granted is to be able to use their hunting permit in the following year. The numbers of those that are addressed by the Division Variance Committee versus the board, the blue ones are the Division Variance Committee that was created in 2008. And the red ones are ones that are addressed by the Wildlife Board. Typically, the board is addressing ones that are situations where somebody's actually hunted, participated in hunting for some part of the season, and then became ill or injured, and they've come to the board and said, could I still have this extended? I didn't harvest. Can I hunt next year? And that's a situation-by-situation call that the board has had to make. But most of the ones, well, all the ones in blue are individuals who've not hunted. So what's the basis for the change in the rule? First of all, we understand that people have unforeseen events in life, and we're trying to make these individuals whole in the best way we can. People wait a long time in many cases to draw these hunting permits and have these opportunities, and we want to work with individuals the best we can to try to help them out. Additionally, it's acknowledged that we need to be careful that if that growth continues, we got to be careful we're not pushing a lot of hunts into future years, because those stack on top of future year hunt recommendations. At this point, the number is probably low enough that really hasn't been a resource issue, but it could be if we continue to see growth like we've seen in the last few years. And finally, we need to be cautious that these events don't have a financial impact to the division as well. All right, the variance relief. The division may grant a variance to a person that is substantially precluded, and I'm going to tell you what that definition is in just a moment, from hunting because of personal illness or injury, death or significant injury or illness to an immediate family member or group member, military deployment or mobilization. A variance must be received by division within 120 days of season closure or application deadline. So the 120 days is a change. That was 200 days before, so we're trying to accelerate a little bit the contact that we have with these individuals. Okay, first of another one, there's no guarantees. Variances, sometimes it's a little bit, we have to have some discretion in there, because when someone comes in and says, I was ill or injured so I couldn't go hunting during the season, you know, we have to take a look at that, and typically those are approved, but someone comes in and says, you know, I broke my finger so I couldn't go hunting, we may not want to grant them that variance because we didn't think that really necessarily precluded them. But typically that's not what happens in these cases. These are mostly pretty real life events that, we've tried to work with people on. So I don't think there's been abuse in the numbers that you've seen, or if there has, it's been very minimal. So in the new definition we have, substantially precluded. Before, if you had hunted even 1 minute and then got hurt, you were out. And you could go to the board, and not many did, and the board often did not approve that. What we're saying now is if you've hunted up to a day, one full day or less, and you didn't harvest anything, we'll assume that you were precluded or didn't really have a full opportunity. If it goes longer than a day, maybe, you know, it's unfortunate, but that's kind of a line we draw. It's a bit arbitrary, but that's what we've come up with is 1 day. So that's still better than, you know, 5 minutes in the field and fell off my horse and broke my leg or crashed the ATV, and those are some that we see quite often. Types of variances. So what are we going to do to help these folks out now? There's three possibilities we have. One is waiving a waiting period, and saying we'll let you back in. I'll explain how that would pertain in just a moment. Bonus and preference point restoration. So rather than just saying here you can hunt next year, what we're looking at doing is saying here we'll give you all your points back and even one that you would have earned this year had you not drawn. So if you drew a permit with 10 points, we'll give you the 10 back and one you to earn that year. So you get 11 points. So it kind of makes you whole as though this event had not happened. And then there's some categories that we're still proposing a season extension, and I'll mention those in just a moment. Okay, so the first ones, what are preference point restoration? So these categories here are ones that you're in preference point for, not bonus points. So general deer, antlerless elk, I'll let you read all those. But essentially none of these categories are eligible for a season extension, but they are eligible to get their point back or their points back, and hopefully then they would draw it the following year. Okay, bonus point restoration or waiting period. So this is pretty much like the last category, except these are for bonus points. So anybody who had drawn a sportsman convention, once in a lifetime, limited entry, public CWMU, or antlerless moose could get all their points back. Now the first category, sportsman and convention, is a little bit tricky because you didn't have to have any points to draw either of those permits. So in those instances, what we're recommending is that you could still be eligible to go back in other draws. Right now, if you draw a convention or sportsman, say once in a lifetime sheep permit, you can no longer go back in the regular division draw and apply. It kind of erases your points, or it makes you ineligible. So we're saying here is if that happens, we don't have any points to give you back, but we will reinstate your eligibility to go back in the draw. Once in a lifetime, I wanted to mention that a little bit. We had a lot of internal discussion. Should that be one that we would grant a season extension on, the once in a lifetime, because it's difficult to draw those in many cases. And some people, you know, would hope that we could help push those permits forward and extend them. For now, we've left them here, but that's certainly something that you could discuss if you have any interest. You could discuss all of this, but that's one that we struggle with a little bit. The reason we opted to leave it here is that some permits, like a San Juan bull elk permit, can take you as long or longer to draw than most of the once in a lifetime. So at that point, you go, well, should we move the limited entry? And pretty soon, we're right back where we are now. So it's a little bit tricky, but we've left it here now. Some permits we're recommending still can have a season extension. Conservation, poaching reward, private CWMU, if they get approval of the landowner, and limited entry landowner. And let me explain why. Most of these have a third party, except for the poaching reward ones. We've never, to my knowledge, we've never extended a poaching reward permit. So the other ones have a third party involved, be a landowner, conservation group, something. It can be up to a year from the time that these people maybe buy a conservation permit or CWMU, from the time they buy it until the season comes and then goes even 120 days later. At that point, these dollars, say conservation permit dollars, may have already been gone to use for a habitat project or whatever. Now, there's no, we can't send them back to a sportsman's group would say, go get all your money back from them, because they may have already given that money to us and we've gone and spent it somewhere. So it kind of adds an interesting twist with third parties in this situation. So these permits, we're recommending that they could move forward and be extended. Now, private CWMUs, the individual, not the division, but the individual is going to have to contact the landowner. If the landowner is willing to add one more permit on their property the following year and not reduce any of their other permits, it's okay, you know, for us to let them do that. If the landowner doesn't want to work with the individual, then we wouldn't be able to do that. So, okay, one other thing. Groups. Group members receive the same variance relief granted by the division to any single member of the group under the rule. What we've found in the last few years is a lot of times an individual comes in, maybe two of them put in together and do limited entry bull elk tags, for example, and one of them comes in, is ill or injured, we extend them to the next season. The other group member, at that point, has to hunt that year. And if these people are from out of state or if they're family or whatever, we're fragmented. Now we've got limited entry permits, for example, in two different hunt years. So what we're saying is we're willing to do for your whole group what we're willing to do for you. But remember, we're not generally, in this situation, groups at all wouldn't be extended into a future year. So all we're doing is saying, okay, group members, you can all have your points back. A lot of them may not want that relief because they still want to go hunting. But at times, group members really, this is kind of a big event and they don't want to have it, you know, a variety of different outcomes in that situation. Okay, the last thing, and it's kind of a interesting new thing for the division. Normally the Wildlife Board can hear appeals of almost any situation or rule that occurs out there. What we don't want to do is put this rule in place, enforce it, and then have individuals say, I don't like what you did, you know, not granted me being able to hunt next year or whatever. So we're putting in this rule a provision that says this cannot be appealed to the Wildlife Board. It will be the only rule we have in place that you can't appeal to the Wildlife Board. So any of these criteria, more than 120 days, more than hunting one day, some of these different things, they killed an animal, you can't go to the board and ask for a variance. So this will help keep our board meetings from getting too congested as well. And that's all I have tonight. Thank you.
Okay. Questions from the rack.
Mr. Sheehan, how many once-in-a-lifetime big game tags are allocated annually?
A few hundred, and I don't know that.
Okay, so it's a relatively negligible number compared to
everything
else.
Yeah.
Okay, let me formulate the next question I've got for that. How many points does it generally take to draw, for instance, a once-in-a-lifetime moose tag?
Well, to be guaranteed, you need this year 19 points to be guaranteed.
Okay, so
any other point could be between zero and eight because the way we divide half and half. So there isn't really, there's so few permits, so few hunts, it's hard to really say a standard. It really becomes
luck. It's a very large amount of time.
Typically.
Okay.
For any of the once in a lifetime.
Any other questions? Questions from the audience? Comments?
I feel as if it takes someone 2 decades to draw a tag to hunt for a big game species, that a season extension for a major life event for a one-year extension wouldn't be exceeding the realm of possibility for me. I don't think that seems excessive. When you've waited that long to draw a tag, I don't know how you guys feel about that.
What kind of a...
So let's say you get on a once-in-a-lifetime moose hunt, and the day you get up there, you climb on your horse, it bucks you off, you roll down an embankment, you break your back. You're out for a year. So let's say you appeal to the board, and the way that this is written here, you would have your bonus points restored, potentially, not necessarily guaranteed, or your waiting period waived, depending on what the situation is, most likely your bonus points restored, and could not have a season extension. So if we moved that over into the bracket of a season extension, then an individual would be able to appeal to the board to have the tag the subsequent year versus only having it, having your points restored.
That's mostly accurate, but you mentioned then they'd then you could appeal to the board to have a variance for the next, so you wouldn't even need to appeal.
Okay.
If you met that criteria,
then that would extend it. Then that would be
without
extended.
Without going to the board or anywhere.
And because there's such a negligible amount of the once-in-a-lifetime tags, and I understand that there is exponential growth in the amount of variances that have been granted, but given that there's so few tags on this, I don't see that necessarily clogging the system for subsequent years. Would that be an accurate guess, that with as many once-in-a-lifetime tags there are, people don't want to miss their opportunity the year that they're going out, most people won't appeal or ask for the variance?
Any other comments?
So then I've got just a different question. So, of course, if they're injured and they get a variance, they don't get a refund on their license, do they?
No, there's no refunds. If you're injured and surrender that, you could get your money back under our refund rule, but you don't get all these different variants. So, basically, because the problem we have is bad as we feel that life events occur. If we start giving everybody their money back now, an individual had a problem, and now we're starting to have a problem. So we can't really ensure that. But usually money isn't the biggest factor when these sorts of things come up. The biggest factor is what's happening to my opportunity here. Mm-hmm. How can I be helped? That's the phone call we're getting more than, hey, can I have my money all back?
Going to the board meetings, I've seen some variance requests that I kind of roll my eyes about, and I'm glad to see you working these rules over, because there's been some there that I didn't. One guy was on his four-wheeler and he'd been scouting, and he hunted for 3 or 4 days and rolled his four, so he turned in a variance request, and I thought, gosh, you know. So I'm glad to see this will eliminate a lot of the variances that go to the board, right?
Almost all of them.
Yeah. I'm sure you won't mind, will you? Yeah. So we have no comment cards, so with that, I'll call for a motion. Vaughn has made the motion. Wayne, second it. All those in favor? We got. Are you in favor?
Just one amendment. That's
all. All those opposed? Carrie, would you like to comment on why?
I would just like to see the amendment added for the once in a lifetime be moved to the season extension bracket, and that's the only change I would like to see made on that. Just because I feel that the once in a lifetime is rather superior.
Okay. Motion passes.
Nope.
Okay. Deer management plan.
Hey, I'm Randall Thacker. I'm staying with Charlie Greenwood tonight. He's out of town, so I'll be covering these real quickly. These it's time to update our unit, our deer and elk unit plans. These are for the individual units we have. You've done the statewide plans for deer and for elk. Made changes again last draft, of course, on the statewide deer plan, on the bucktail to doe ratio objective, and things like that are there. And each of our units also has a unit management plan specific for that unit. So what we're doing is where it's time to update those units. And we'll just cover those that are really within our region. If I can get this to point well enough, in our region, this red boundary is our regional boundary here. You've got the book cliffs. We've also broken this out by subunits. Sorry, those colors aren't as clear as I was hoping they would be for the numbers to break it out. This also shows the different subunits. You've got the book cliffs, the bonanza. You've got the entire south slope coming across here. This is unit 9A, B, and C, and D. That's the Yellowstone, the vernal, the diamond, the bonanza, for example. And that's all one unit. The management plan covers the entire unit, but we do have subunits and some separate objectives.
The North Slope, for example, is A, B, and C that cuts across on it, too. And so each there is subunit objectives and things like that, too, in each of these units. And just to make sure everybody's familiar with how what the units are in our region. So if you have any questions, feel free to ask. The deer plan units, each individual unit starts off with a boundary description. It also has some summaries of some big tables in there of land ownership, different types of habitat. That's a lot of stuff. Most of these things are a lot of information that you probably don't care too much about, but it's how we break out and make some decisions that we use. And so that's all included in these management plans. But none of that's really changed much, and we'll go through that today as we go through each unit just real quickly because there's very few real changes. There is one change, a population objective on elk that we'll get to in a few minutes. The habitat objectives, for the most part, we address different issues on there, and they're usually pretty generic problems, dealing with winter range situations or maybe highway mortality on certain units like that. And then we also, though, for each unit, have the range trend information, which is the state has the, some of you have probably heard the presentations before from them, but they have a statewide crew that comes around. Every 5 years, they rotate around the state. So every 5 years, each region, they come to the region and do some real habitat monitoring is what it is, and it's very specific. It's very quantitative. They go in and they have set transects that they go to each year, read the transects, and every 5 years when they come through. Every 5 years they come and read those transects to really get a real trend for the vegetation there. Is it improving? Is it decreasing? Are you having a real weed problem, et cetera? And so we'll address, and then we summarize. There's a number of those on each of these units, and we kind of summarize those briefly here to look at how our habitat in general is doing on the individual units. So we'll start off with the deer units is on the agenda there. We'll start with deer units. The first one here we'll look at, talk about, is the North Slope deer unit, unit number 8. There are three separate subunits on that unit, but they have just one population objective for the entire North Slope. The buck doe ratio is set in the plan to be under the general season guidelines according to the statewide plan. All of these units will be that way as it comes through. The statewide plan will define these buck doe ratios. But just to give you the information, it's not specific in the plan, but just to give you what was voted on last week by the Wildlife Board, the North Slope will be 18 to 20 bucks will be the objective, the buck to doe ratio for that unit. Also, a lot of these units will have predator management plans associated with them, especially with our region right now. We have basically every unit almost in our region is under predator management. The North Slope has a small asterisk next to that, yes. Predator management means we'll do more intensive predator control, coyotes and cougars. And then we also though, do have them for different species that we'll target it at. The other units in our region all have it specifically targeting deer, too. The North Slope, because the deer herd up there has been doing actually a little better than some of the other units are, it's not quite as bad off, I guess, as some of the others for the long term until just recently. And that unit does not specifically have a predator management plan for deer included, but it does have it in there for cougars, to target cougar populations because of the bighorn sheep that are up around Flaming Gorge in those areas. If it continues on the trend it's on right now, it probably will have a predator management plan for deer up on that unit, which would increase coyote control in some of those efforts, too. The DCI ranking on unit number 8, on unit 8A, which is the summit, it's the portion, it's the north slope of the UN, is essentially the farthest west portion, not in our region. Those range trend sites there are showing up as excellent, an excellent habitat condition. Now, when you come to our region, the West Agate and the Three Corners unit, those habitat sites on the average for the units and those habitat monitoring sites in our region, they are right now ranking as a good ranking. They fall into that good classification, and they are doing fairly well for the most part. We do have a few individual sites that are struggling, and we try to address those with habitat projects and things. But in general, this unit, the habitat, appears to be doing better than some in the state, that's for sure. So. Any questions on unit number 8? We'll go through them that way. Unit number 9 is the South Slope. As I mentioned before, that's the Yellowstone, the Vernal, the Diamond Mountain, and the Bonanza. Big chunk, kind of the center of our region out there. Those units out there, our population objective, we do have it broken up kind of as an east half and a west half for an objective in the plan. That's continuing like it's been before. A total of 26,000 deer is the population objective for that unit. And this is a wintering population number, too. These, right now, the west half objective is for half of the deer for 13,000, and the Vernal Diamond and Bonanza unit having another 13,000 there. As you look at the, this one gets a little confusing for buck-doe ratio because, again, now with the change, and again, what the plan states for buck-doe ratio is a general season buck-doe, whatever is set in the statewide plan. But what was approved last week is for the Yellowstone subunit will be 18 to 20 bucks will be managed for. The Vernal and the Bonanza will be managed for a 15 to 27. The Diamond Mountain is already a limited entry unit. It will be managed for a 25 to 35. And all those numbers come straight from the statewide plan. The South Slope is being does right now have a current predator management plan for deer, and so that targets both lions and cougar and coyotes and is a target unit for predator control. The DCI ranking for the South Slope, which is our, again, it's a habitat index, kind of is really what that is. Desirable Condition Index is what the DCI stands for. I should have said that. But on the Yellowstone unit currently, it is has actually been on an improving, slightly improving trend, and it is in good condition. All these sites, I should have said too, were red in 2010. So just last year, they were red. Over here on the Vernal, Diamond and Bonanza, it's struggling a little more in certain areas. We've got areas on the Vernal that are in poor condition. And there's other higher elevation sites, though, that are ranking in the good condition. And so it depends, more site-specific on the east side over here, it appears, for habitat problems. There is one fairly significant change, I guess. It's important enough, a boundary change. I'll show you in the next slide. We'll discuss that, a slight boundary change between A and B. We'll talk about that in just a moment. The other changes that were put into this plan, the Diamond Mountain subunit up here, 9C, this RAC voted a few years ago to move that to have it start moving towards becoming a premium limited entry unit. It is currently a standard limited entry unit. We're moving towards a premium and limited entry unit. We've included that language in the plan, also stating that when the Diamond Mountain reaches the premium status for buck doe ratio as well as an average age of harvest, the objective is once it finally gets to be a premium unit, if it can reach that point, then we would come back and recommend a change and would recommend that to the board that it would become a premium unit. So that kind of reflects the comments and suggestions that we've heard here and also a former RAC vote in the past. We included in this plan that if 9C does become a premium entry, limited entry unit, we would then initiate things that come with the premium status. Possibly, we would consider the possibility of management buck hunts and those kind of things on that unit. Just real quick here, I wanted to just explain the boundary change that's we've done. This kind of goes back to the 30, when we looked at the 30 units, the unit by unit deer, general season deer hunts. This is the boundary difference, but the former boundary went up the Deep Creek Road up towards Paradise Park. If you're familiar with where that is, it actually went to Paradise Park Reservoir, and then climbed up on top of the drainage divide there and went up the drainage divide up to the summit of the Uintas. There's been a lot of we've had concern over the years with making that Deep Creek Road, the road to the Paradise Park Reservoir, having that be a boundary. If a deer runs across the road right there, which is quite common in that area, if you've gone up that, you're familiar with that road, it's vegetated quite heavily on either side in a lot of places. Good deer habitat, very good chance that deer and elk are going to run back and forth across that road. We weren't real comfortable leaving that as the hunt boundary there. And so what we've done is we proposed, and I guess it's technically been approved, but we want to explain it better to you here. This change would permanently move the subunit boundary from off of that road. Instead, it'll take it down, so at the top of the unit is what will come down. We'll follow what's currently our mountain goat hunt unit boundary too, which comes down the trail to the White Rocks Lake, follows the White Rocks River out of White Rocks Lake and follows the White Rocks River clear down until it ties into the Uinta River and ties back into the old boundary there. What that does is by moving that boundary down to the White Rocks River, if you're familiar at all with the White Rocks River, there's no road, there's no trail in the bottom, there's very low chance of very many people hunting right near that river. The only site I can even think of anybody hunting would be at the very top up towards White Rocks Lake and Ted's Lake area there. There's a little trail. There is a little potential there, but it's much less than the potential we have for problems with people shooting an animal or seeing an animal, shooting it on one side of the road and it runs across the road, those kind of things on that boundary. So we've recommended going to this new boundary, and that will be for deer and elk. It'll come up in the elk plan too. This would just permanently change that boundary to that new, more defensible boundary. we don't want to make folks who are trying to be honest. We aren't trying. We're trying to keep it so they can obey the law a little easier. That's essentially the idea here. So, the Book Cliffs Management Plan, again, no changes on population objectives. It's 15,000 deer is the objective, 10,000 on the north, and 5,000 on the south. Buck doe ratio, it's standard. Buck to doe, it's standard limited entry, as stated in the statewide plan, and so that's where those numbers come from. It is under predator management plan for deer. Deer are struggling out there too. We've got the habitat index out there again on the DCI ranking out there. On the 10A, which is our region's portion, it ranges from fair to good depending on the sites. It is, some of those sites are showing an improving trend, which is good. I think last year's water really helps out. When they read that on a good wet year, it also benefits them. So there's some changes that way. But it is in a improving trend habitat-wise. The only real significant change on this plan is it's just mentioned in there that if the statewide plan is changed in the future to allow management buck hunts on the standard limited entry units, then management buck hunts could be implemented. But that all is dependent on the statewide plan. The unit number 11 is the 9 mile anthro. No changes per se are recommended. There's no significant changes really on that unit. The population objective of 8,300 deer total. That includes the 9 mile, which is the vast majority of the deer. The 11A there, you can see 2,500 deer is our objective for our region's portion. 11B being the range creek and 9 miles portion of that unit and has the majority of those deer. The buck doe ratio for that, as according now to the statewide plan, is 18 to 20 is the objective. Predator management plan is in place for the anthro, and our habitat in our region on the anthro has actually been improving down there. So the only thing is that doesn't take into account all the new oil wells that have blossomed on that unit, and we've lost a lot of that kind of habitat. So these indexes give you the state of the vegetation. They don't give you a state of all the factors that are going on out there. The Wasatch Mountains, 17B and C are the portions in our region. That's the 17B being the current creek, C the Abinaquin. Population objective, we've recommended no changes there on deer. Our portion there, that's 15,000 deer on the current creek and 3,200 on the Abinaquin subunits there. Again, the statewide plan calls for 18 to 20 buck to doe ratio now. That unit is under a predator management plan, and the vegetation indexes, I guess, the habitat indexes there on our portion of it are, if you qualify into the good category, they are doing a little better. And a lot of that comes back to a lot of the habitat work, watershed initiative work that's been done on some of those units there too. That's the end of the deer plans. Do you want to take them separate, or would you rather continue on with the elk plans too and both of them together, or would you rather handle them as separate items?
What do you feel? I feel like if we did the deer plan first, then we could move on to the elk plan.
Okay.
I think so. That sounds good. Any questions? Questions from the rack?
It looks like, you know, things have been, they've looked at the boundaries and some of that. That's a good change.
You know, question on the boundary change.
That conflict.
Will that be after 1 year?
It'll be for this coming year.
Also, it'll be.
It actually is already on the hunt maps that are out there for coming year. We actually adopted that technically as for a hunt boundary. We've already adopted that this year, or when we did it earlier in the year before, so it could be on the website so people knew that before they. If they get on the website right now, look at a map. It shows the new boundary. This moves our management boundary to that hunt boundary that we've already approved. So yeah.
Any other questions? Questions from the audience? No questions? Comments? Comments from the rack? Just for the record, you know I've discussed this before, but when we do our buck to doe ratios in the fall,
yep,
during the rut, when we go to the Manila area, being as we border the state with a three-pointer better, I still feel that our buck-to-doe ratio, I don't know how accurate it can be, because I do believe there's a lot of bucks that come across the border, because when we do our ratios,
They do a lot of counts in the field, in the fields, and the deer congregate in there, and the bucks are coming out of Wyoming, because I honestly believe that if you go south of Sheep Creek and do a ratio there, and north of Sheep Creek, there'd be a... I'd like to see the information to see how big a difference there would be there.
Absolutely. I'd encourage you to do that. Get with Lowell, your biologist up there, and go look at that. And if not, you know, it'd be really easy this fall to collect it, that, you know, to keep it separate and look at that and to see how much of an issue that is really, and if it is a concern. I will, you know, every unit has its own unique personality. And I do think majority of our units even have areas, though, that are somewhat of a refuge in some way, whether it's another state or it's private property or it's tribal land. Almost every one of them I can think of in our region has something kind of like that that can bias your buck-to-doe ratio somehow. You know what I mean? So I guess it's hard for us to, you know, manage it differently, but definitely I think it's something we could look into and see if it's there. I think you can kind of make that case for a lot of the units and say, well, it's not quite as high this way or that way, you know, because of they're all coming off the private land, or there's CWMUs on that one, or the South Slope and the tribal lands. It is hard. We can only manage them. That's still probably our best way to manage, I think, is still to pick a buck-doe ratio during that rut rather than trying to, you know, get it in a different time of year. So.
And you were saying on the Unit 8 that you felt that the deer was, the population was doing well?
It actually, numbers-wise, has been doing better up there than the rest of our region almost is. So it actually, yeah, the population estimates up there are actually a little higher than in percentage of the objective. They have to be, for the, what I brought that up about was the predator management plan. Is the one of the triggers on that is it how far below objective it is, the first trigger that to decide whether or not we can have a predator management plan for deer on a unit is how far below objective it is. Most of our other units in our region are probably, you know, they're 60% of objective or even some of them 50% almost of objective, where that one's closer to 80% of objective up there. So it's, well, just not as bad as where the others are, let's just say that.
Comment, the county's been paying bounty for a lot of years now, and there seems like there's a coyote contest every weekend, so that could have a bearing on it.
Yeah, definitely can't hurt.
We have no comment cards from the audience. Anybody want to fill one out quick and make a comment?
Can I make one comment?
Oh, that's this.
A month ago at the RAC, you had a couple farmers, ranchers here from the Chews and whatever down there. A lot of them, the Colorado border and south of the Diamond, of the National Park. They wanted to make change. My question to you is, this the time that you could do that?
This could be a time for the discussion. 2 days after the meeting, they came in and visited with Charlie. And okay. and Charlie met with them and talked with them, and Charlie has also met with his biologist over that area and is going to have them get together and talk about their concerns and address their issues. There wasn't enough time to address and look at things between the meetings, and so we are in the process of working with them, and they will continue to do so. Like I said, Charlie's talked to Lowell, and they're going to make contact and get together and have something by November.
Okay.
Hey, Del, I'm going to get lost.
Yeah. No, we are not going to let them fall through the cracks.
I didn't quite hear you on that. Where was that at?
The Blue Mountain.
The Blue Mountain. That Blue Mountain issue.
Highway 40 and the Colorado border.
No other comment? Call for a motion.
A motion we accept the plan as presented.
Beth made the motion. To accept.
Second,
I have a second.
Motion. A second.
Second.
Motion.
That carries. All those in favor? Unanimous? Okay. Elk.
Okay, we'll move on to elk plans. The elk plans are fairly similar, same concept in general, boundaries, you know, all these details that are in there. We'll go through them in the same way. They don't have the DCI index that we were using before, the habitat index. That's specifically geared to how that habitat is, whether it's beneficial for deer. And so that part is not directed. Almost everything benefits elk is really what it comes down to. You do any habitat work, it seems to benefit them. So North Slope, again, no significant changes. The objectives will remain the same. No changes that way. Up there on the North Slope elk, general season on A, B, and the three corners area, of course, will have an age objective. It'll stay the same as stated in the statewide plan. A 5.5 to 6-year-old is the age objective for the North Slope on the three-quarter portion. On the South Slope, the only major change is that boundary change again, just making that so it's consistent, and so we're managing the same things. We're talking about the same boundary every time from now on. And so the majority of the South Slope, with the exception of course, the diamond, is general season. That's any bull harvest across that. There's no age objective for that. It's just general season management. The Diamond Mountain is currently on the statewide plan list at 6.5 to 7-year-old is the age objective for elk on that unit. The Book Cliffs, again, no change is recommended here, other than there is a current sub-study going on right now on aspen out on the Book Cliffs, and there is some real concerns about aspen. Elk numbers can impact aspen in some areas. We don't want to add to the problem with that, but there is a study going on with that one, and depending on what the findings of those studies turn out to be in the future, when this plan is renewed in 5 years, that we specifically put in there that we would consider those findings and reevaluating the population objective when the plan is renewed in 5 years. Other than that, the age objectives you can see there, the A and B is 6.5 to 7-year-old. The roadless area is 7.5 to 8-year-old. On the age objective for elk. The 9-mile anthro, again, no recommended changes there. The 911A will be managed for 5.5 to 6-year-old objective as stated in the statewide plan. The 9-mile range creek portion is now general season and will be managed as a general season unit down there. Wasatch Mountains. The population objectives is the only real change that's made there. This is the only unit in our region that we recommended a change in the population objective. The 17C, which is the Wasatch Mountains of Viniquin, the elk have been doing quite well down there for several years. There's been a lot of changes in land ownership down there. Some habitat property that has actually been bought down there either by Mitigation Commission down in some of those areas that has picked up some wintering range down there. The state acquired the Lake Canyon property a number of years ago, and there's been some real productive and beneficial habitat projects down there. A committee was formed over there, an elk unit committee specific for this subunit. There's a whole process that's actually identified in rule who has to be included on those committees. I think some of you have been involved with them in the past, but there's representatives from the county, representatives of the cattlemen, the local grazers on those units, as well as private landowners on those units, and some sportsmen's reps. Rod isn't here tonight. He was on that committee here as the RAC representative, also as a sportsmen's rep. And the committee met there, discussed the options to increase the population objective on that unit, and the final vote was to decide to raise the objective to 1,600 on that subunit. So that's an increase there of 350 elk, on wintering elk on that subunit. So, and that's all the changes we really have.
Questions from the RAC?
Are they seeing massive detriment of the aspens in the cliffs?
Are they seeing massive detriment, is that what you said? There is some areas that they're concerned about. I'd probably have to defer to Dax to name specific spots, but there are some areas they're concerned about. We've seen some similar concerns in the past on anthro. Some of those turned out to be justified, and some turned out not to be. But there's some other impacts going on out there, too. There's some blight and some other. I can defer that one to Bob if he wants to comment on it later on. The forest has done a lot of studies there. We've done some exclosures and some things there. Found out there's a lot of other things hurting the aspen, too. It wasn't just elk, either. But elk are definitely can impact and aspen, especially young regenerating the young aspen.
Right.
And if it's very limited in availability out there, Anthro Mountain, there's only, six big aspen patches on that mountain. Mm-hmm. And when it's very limited like that, they can get hit pretty hard. They can have an impact. So we do have to want to watch that and not create be part of the problem.
Interesting. Thank you.
Any other questions? Questions from the audience?
J.C. Brewer, I have two questions. On Unit 17, where you was recommending an increase in the elk numbers, I didn't see in the, I probably missed it, but I didn't see how the deer unit was doing, or deer herd was doing on that same unit. Anybody got any information?
The deer unit down there has been fairly stagnant, actually, for the last probably 8 to 10 years. It's decreased in long term. It's down like most other units in the state are. But it's a very unique unit. We went in there a number of years ago and put in a whole radio collar study just to try to figure out why those deer weren't coming back down there. And what we found is it's pretty much a wintering unit for deer from other places. There's very few summer and fall deer. None of the radio collars stayed on the unit through that were wintering in those that we collared in those areas. We even went to the next unit to the east onto the anthro and thought those deer must be the one that moved there, and there's very few of those deer stay in the summer or in the fall. But we also have found that the elk essentially do the same thing. They all kind of show up for the winter is what it really is. But it is a struggling unit, and it's been struggling for a long time. It's not something that's just recent. It's been struggling for at least 25-plus years, if not 40, that's been down out there. It's kind of like the anthro. That whole south of Highway 40 portion over there seems to really be struggling for mule deer and just isn't bouncing back all that way.
Okay. The reason I asked that was I questioned the wisdom of increasing wildlife numbers on a unit when we're having difficulty with another species in the same unit. My other question is on the aspen study in the book cliffs. I see a lot of the little cages around the aspen groves, some of them. Book cliffs has a very limited amount of aspen, and I have for years had felt that the elk were about 80% of the problem with our aspen out there, getting no regeneration, no young trees coming up. If the studies that we're doing now, this five-year study, shows a significant amount of damage to our aspen groves by elk, is there a possibility of actually decreasing the number of elk in book cliffs?
Yeah, any kind of change could be made at that point. We could change the objective. This board could do whatever it would like to do at that time. And
based on that information, how would we proceed?
As far as numbers, there will be a committee form. Time we change a population objective, there will be a committee put together of interested individuals, as well as what's dictated by law who has to be included on the committee. It would meet prior before we came to this point. It would have been done this last summer, per se, or last winter or something. There would have been a committee at least 6 months prior to where we would make a recommendation on it. The committee would be formed, and they would go through include the forest service, include the data and the evidence there, and the other interested parties, and they would kind of work through to come up with the population recommendation.
Are we in our first year of this study?
I believe. I don't know. I don't know.
If the study's been done through USU, and I think there's still the division, we provided some input, look at the study design, but I don't think they're going to implement the study until next year. This started. I think it's a 3-year study that will be finished by the time the plan comes up to review. So, and the division, all we said was do your study and then let's look at it in 5 years, and if it shows there's cause for concern, and we're convening out the video and just look at the numbers to see if there's something we needed to do to address the issue.
I guess we need to figure out when the end
And I can talk to Utah State and tell you for sure, it's not a division study, it's one that's a BLM and cooperating with USU on. We had some input, but it's not a division study.
So it would be at least 3 years, kind of 3 years from now.
That's my understanding. I'll follow up and let you know.
I've got a question for you. Is any of the habitat money been spent on aspen?
Aspen regeneration.
Regeneration?
Wish our habitat guys were here to tell us if there is. A majority of that has been spent mostly on sagebrush step habitats and pin and juniper treatment and stuff. There is a little bit in the state that has been spent on some aspen regeneration, but that's actually the future focus where they want to move to. One of the places they want to go to next and kind of start focusing on is the aspen regeneration. And because aspen is a concern, you know, we are losing it in some places. There's all kinds of things hitting it too. So as of yet, in our region anyway, I can't think of anything specific where the Habitat Initiative has spent a lot on nothing significant anyway,
we
done on aspen regeneration.
A little bit on that for what you described burning aspen.
That's true.
Kind of trigger some regeneration.
Looks to me like aspen's pretty delicate, aren't they?
As you put fire through it, it stimulates regeneration and growth.
Mr. Brewer, if you want to call and talk to Dave Palmer, our forester at the BLM, he is working on that study, and he'd be glad to talk to you. Dave Palmer.
Dave Palmer.
Give him a call, and he's working with the USU on that study.
Any other questions? Comments?
I'll just make one. I'll just bring a comment on the deer that with the Binnick, that was brought up in the committee, that was talked about, increasing the elk objective and the impacts it could have on deer. That was discussed in the committee. And then the other thing was the population estimate is 1950, I think, if I remember right. So one thing that we talked about in the committee was there was raising the population objective to 1,600 is still going to, there still needs to be a decrease on the amount of elk that are currently out there. So there'll still be issue of cow tags out there to try to get the population.
That's correct, yeah. It's over objective, even over the new objective still, it will still be a little over that, so it will need to be reduced, continue to be reduced on that unit. Our biggest problem in our region in general with elk is not creating them. It's killing, being able to kill enough antlerless animals to actually control the population.
I might also just mention on that, permittees, they were in agreement with that, and they knew about the rack being denied. I thought they might be here, but they didn't show up. But anyway, they were in agreement with that as well.
Another comment from the rack. We have two cards. Troy?
Troy Justinson, Sportsman, Fish and Wildlife. We just asked the RAC to support the division in the recommendations for the elk plan. As far as sports fishing wildlife goes, we do support the recommendations. Thank you.
And Josh.
Josh Horick, speaking as a sportsman, outfitter, and a cattle rancher. With the landowner vouchers, the state had compensated landowners for deer and elk. We're plumb fine with putting more deer and elk on the mountain and support the division and hope the RAC does too with their elk recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, seeing no other comments, call for a motion.
A motion, we accept the plan as presented.
Do I have a second? Bob? Okay. All those in favor? Passes unanimously. Looks to me like the other items are region-specific and we're not on there. Meeting adjourned.